This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is filmmaker Rodney Evans. After he started losing his eyesight when he was in his 20s, Evans wanted to continue to make movies, and he still has enough sight left to enable him to do that. He wanted to know what it was like for other artists who have lost much or all of their vision, and he wanted their advice. That led to his new documentary, Vision Portraits. It tells his story and the stories of three other blind or partially sighted artists, a photographer, a dancer, and a writer. Evan says all the artists in the film are deeply influenced and motivated by the power of art to heal and transform. Evans also wrote and directed the film Brother to Brother, which won the Special Grand Jury Prize at the 2004 Sundance Film Festival. It starred Anthony Mackie as a young gay man who meets an older gay man who was part of a circle of artists and writers during the Harlem Renaissance. Evans is now working on a film dramatizing the life of composer and pianist Billy Strayhorn, who worked with Duke Ellington for most of his career. Rodney Evans, welcome to Fresh Air. I think a lot of our audience will be wondering, how can you make movies if you can hardly see? So let's start with, what can you see? How much vision remains?
I have about 9% of vision in one eye and 8% in the other eye, and it fluctuates. So sometimes that goes up and sometimes that goes down, but in general it's about 20%. Of vision, but it is very localized in the center. So the condition I have, which is technically called retinitis pigmentosa, basically destroys your peripheral vision. So it leaves you with no peripheral vision and very minimal night vision. But I do have very clear central vision. So my vision is often I describe it as akin to looking through a telescope or a horse with blinders.
A telescope, but without the magnification.
Exactly.
So let's talk about how you direct a film with your limited eyesight. How do you see who you're directing? How close are you to the shot that you're framing? Or are you watching on a monitor?
You know, it depends on, A, whether it's documentary or fiction, right? So usually with a fiction film, I'm collaborating with a cinematographer and we're shot listing and doing storyboards and really talking about what's at the emotional core of each scene and what's the best way to shoot it. So all of that work is done before I get to the set, right? And so when I'm on set, I am really solely focused on the performances and on the actors and helping the actors to get where they need to be emotionally for the scene as it fits into the larger whole of the film. That is the sole responsibility of the director. Like, and I actually feel like having no peripheral vision is an asset to that because I don't see any of the lighting equipment being put up. I don't see, you know, the flags that are taking the halo off of the actress's head. You know, there are just certain things that are not visible to me. So I'm literally like zeroed in on what is going on the actors' faces and where they are emotionally and where they need to be for the particular scene that we're shooting. And so I tend to not stand behind a monitor. I tend to stand quite close to the actors. My entire crew knows about my visual impairment, so there's no confusion about what I need, whether or not I need a clear path to the actors. So a lot of times it's just letting people know what you need.
Why did you want to make a film about other visually impaired artists who've continued to do their work?
Because I was terrified, frankly, about losing my vision and whether or not I would be able to continue creating films and doing this art form that I was really passionate about. So, you know, I just have this tendency of confronting my fears head on. So if something terrifies me, I know that that's where I need to go as an artist. And just to you know, take that to the end point and just think to myself, okay, so what if you do go blind? what would happen? How would you create your art? How do other people do it? How would a blind photographer continue to make photographs? How would a blind writer continue to write essays and memoirs and screenplays? How would a visually impaired dancer navigate the space of a stage, not knowing where the obstacles on the stage might be? All of that just became really fascinating to me.
John Dugdale, the can I call him blind? Is that...
Yeah. He prefers to be called blind.
Oh, okay.
He actually gets angry when people call him visually impaired.
Okay. Yeah. So something else that John Dugdale, the blind photographer, told you is that since he had vision and then lost it after he got AIDS and had a stroke, that he still has all this like visual memory, and he's able to see things in his mind even though he can't see them with his eyes. And he actually says to you that the last time he saw the world was in 1994, and if he got his sight back now, he'd probably throw up, he said. He said so much has changed, he hasn't seen friends and family get older. And I can't say I've ever thought of it that way, that if you lose your sight and then years go by, the people who you know, who you're close to, friends, family, partners, like they... you don't know how they've aged. You can't see it.
Right.
Did that make you think a lot to you?
It did make me think a lot, and it's something that a lot of people talk about. You know, Ryan Knighton, the writer in the film, also talked about not being able to see his face, you know, for the past over 20 years, you know. And so I think... for people like John and Ryan, the world is kind of frozen. And John describes it as a state of bliss, you know, where everyone's hair looks great. No one's aging. Everyone is in peak form. And he's remembering them like that, you know. So for him, it really is this pristine condition that he remembers all of his friends in. And so he hasn't seen them deteriorate. He has a real focus on the beauty in the world, and so that's what he, I think, focuses on in terms of his memories and in terms of the people that he loves in his life.
I think you didn't initially plan to include yourself in the movie. You're just going to do about other people who are blind or partially sighted. Why didn't you want to include yourself, and why did you decide, well, you will include yourself?
Initially, I thought of myself as a framing device, that I would talk about my condition and my fears around losing my vision and continuing to work as a filmmaker, and that being the reasoning behind why I was searching out and looking at the creative processes of these different artists. But as I was editing, it just became more and more clear that people were interested in me as a character and were interested in how I was absorbing the stories that I was hearing. I think some of my reluctance to being in the film was actually being depicted on screen with a red and white cane, you know, which is a signifier for blindness. I think I spent a lot of time in the industry not wanting people to know that I was visually impaired for fear that that would be damaging to career possibilities and would limit my career possibilities. And then after a while, it became really clear that I was having a certain kind of conversation with these artists, and it was an insider's conversation. So, you know, I knew what it was like to finally accept the fact that you needed to take out this cane in order to navigate the world, both for your own safety and for the safety of others, and what a hard decision that is to make. I know what it is to crack my head against a subway pole and fall down and have blood dripping down the center of my head. So I think I was able to have a certain kind of trust and an intimacy in the interviews because I was coming from the perspective of someone who was a low vision artist and understood from the inside what their perspective was.
Did you initially think, I have to give up the idea of becoming a filmmaker because I'm losing my vision?
I didn't, really, because I had so much vision left to work with. And the way that it was presented to me was that I had lost as much as I was going to lose for a significant amount of time, and that it seemed to be plateauing, and that I just needed to keep monitoring it like every 3 to 4 months. And frankly, at that time, I had also just come out as gay to my conservative Jamaican family, which was also a real emotional rupture in my life. And I think that as human beings, we have such capacity to compartmentalize our experiences. So for me, that experience was much more emotional in some ways, and I was much more drawn to trying to make sense of that experience on film by any means necessary. So I made a short film called Close to Home, which led to my fiction debut feature called Brother to Brother. And that really took over my life for 6 years. And that is all I focused on. And with the vision, it was just like, this is something you have. You can't do anything about it. Or rather, you're doing what they tell you to do in order to maintain the vision that you have. And, you know, you play the cards that you're dealt, right? And so that was how I dealt with it and focused on filmmaking. But if anything, it was more galvanizing in terms of getting the projects done that were burning inside of me.
So was the prognosis correct that you wouldn't be losing more vision in the near future?
It was correct. You know, I say that it really didn't start to deteriorate more till about probably 12 to 13 years later.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And that was when I started to commute a lot from Penn Station to 30th Street Station in Philadelphia for a college teaching job that I had. And I just was bumping into many, many people. People were getting very angry at Penn Station. So I was like, you know, in order for me to avoid a physical altercation, because New Yorkers do not mess around. Like, if you bump into them, like, that could get, you know, mm-hmm. It could get violent really quickly. So I decided that was the point that I needed this red and white cane, both to help me navigate spaces like Penn Station, but also as a way of signifying to other people that I was visually impaired and that there wasn't an issue and that I wasn't just bumping into them to be aggressive, right? I think especially as a young Black male, it's an aggressive act, and it's that much more prone to be looked at as a hostile act.
So you kind of had two coming outs, one as a gay man and the other as a visually impaired person, because I think you were trying to cover it up for a while by not carrying a cane. And there were a lot of people who you didn't tell. So when you found out about the visual impairment, how did you decide who you were going to tell and who you were going to not tell?
In terms of my work as a filmmaker, I always told my crew. I always told, the producers that I was working with. I always told the actors that I was working with. You know, there's a lot going on, and sets are like chaotic places, right? So if somebody hands me a call sheet, which is just the information for the next day of shooting, like where the location is, who the actors are that are involved, what are the props that are involved. So if somebody hands me a call sheet and I don't see it, and they feel like I am ignoring them, that could easily be perceived as a snub, right? As some form of like denigration. And so for me, it became really important just at first crew meeting to be like, hey, I'm visually impaired. So in terms of the work process, that was always front and center. The people that were closest to me, obviously my family knew, and they were helping me to get medical care. My friends that were closest to me knew. But, you know, other people outside of that close, intimate circle didn't know, frankly. And I think it caused a lot of confusion. And people probably judged me in a negative way because of it. I think there are a lot of people who probably waved hello to me at, you know, a function and I didn't see it, and they thought it was a snub when it was really something where I just didn't see them. And so I think the red and white cane just helped to signify to them that there was a visual impairment going on and that it wasn't me, you know, being snotty or trying to, you know, put them down in any way, or, you know, it just made things clear. And so, yeah, it just helped with social awkwardness and embarrassment.
You were telling us that you started losing your vision and got your diagnosis at the same time that you decided to come out. And so, like, coming out and also making the movies you were making at the time were so, took up so much psychic and physical energy that the vision loss was almost in second place. So since you made a film about coming out, I want to talk with you a little bit about that.
Okay.
You say that your parents were, or are, I'm not sure if they're still alive, conservative. Before you came out, did you sense that they were homophobic and that this was going to be very frightening to them?
Yes. And I guess I should qualify the term conservative, because I think that that has so many connotations. You know, my parents are Jamaican, and so my dad passed away in 2003, and my mom is still alive and is super proud of my films, right? But you know, they are Jamaican, and I think Jamaica, you know, I have to say, is probably one of the most homophobic countries in the world, and I don't say that lightly. And, you know, being of Jamaican ancestry, it's painful for me to say that, but I do think that it's true. And I understood all of the cultural baggage and influences that my parents had from growing up in Jamaica. So yes, I did know that it was going to be incredibly difficult for them to handle my coming out as gay. And I had always been this kind of straight A student that, you know, went to the Ivy League college that, you know, that they could be super proud of and brag about to their friends that how well I was doing. And, you know, almost emblematic of their success immigrating to this country, you know, like what I was able to achieve, right? And so I think coming out worked counter to that story for them.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say that they still were very supportive of my art making, and still, even though, you know, was fully gay and dealt with, you know, LGBT history during the Harlem Renaissance and in my film, yeah. So they were financial supporters of that film. And you know, my dad unfortunately didn't live to see the film, but my mom, you know, went with her Jamaican friends on, you know, the weekend that it opened at Cinema Village in New York, and they bought tickets and they sat there and they watched it, you know. And I do think that the film slowly influenced my mom's opinions about gay lifestyles and her homophobia, and I think there was just a huge shift that came as a result of that film and it being so outspokenly and unabashedly gay, and me being out as a gay filmmaker and her having to say, yeah, that's my son, and I'm proud of him, and I'm proud of the work that he's doing, and defending me to people that probably didn't understand what I was making or why I needed to tell those stories.
Well, in terms of your life, in a world that's still filled with racism and homophobia, you're in the position of being African-American, gay, and partially sighted. And so you add racism, homophobia, and vision impairment together, and, you know, that's a lot.
Right.
I'm not saying, it, you know, I'm just saying in terms of obstacles, in terms of how the world perceives you.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. It just reminds me of a James Baldwin quote when people asked him what it was like to, you know, be both black and gay. And his response was something to the effect of, you know, I won the lottery. You know, being both facetious, but also being, I think, honest in a really astute way, in that when you are marginalized, you see the center in a much more clear-sighted way, right? So, you know, I think as a black, gay, disabled individual, I am able to see white mainstream culture from a very, you know, white mainstream able-bodied culture in a very specific kind of way. You know, for me, it's quite shocking that one in four people identify as having a disability, but, you know, 0.2% of characters in films that we see have a disability. That's a huge void between actual lived experiences and what gets reflected back to us on screen.
Rodney Evans, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Rodney Evans directed the new documentary Vision Portraits. There's a new effort to eliminate the gender biases implicit in our pronouns. Universities have encouraged students to pick the pronouns they want to be called by, like he, she, or they. Newspapers have been changing their style guides, and cities are rewriting their ordinances with gender-neutral pronouns. Some recent research from Sweden suggests that using such pronouns can reduce people's sexist assumptions. But these changes have incited some very vocal opposition. Here's what our linguist Jeff Nunberg has to say.
Letter for letter, no part of speech gets people more worked up than pronouns do. Linguistic history is dotted with eruptions of pronoun rage. Right now, the provocation is the gender-neutral pronouns that some non-binary people have asked to be called by, so they won't have to be identified as he or she. There are several of these in circulation. Some are new words like Z and co, but some go back a ways. In fact, people have been proposing new gender-neutral pronouns for 150 years, though none has ever caught on. But the most popular choice, and probably the most controversial one, is the familiar pronoun that people describe as the singular they. You can see why people would pick they. In everyday speech, we often use that pronoun for a single person, though only when the word or phrase it substitutes for, its antecedent as it's called, doesn't refer to a specific individual. So we say, somebody lost their wallet, or if a student fails, they have to retake the course. Or the person we're referring to may be simply unknown. Your daughter's cell phone rings at the dinner table. You say, tell them you'll call them back. Male or female, one caller or several. The pronoun they is like, whatever. That singular they goes back hundreds of years. Jane Austen's novels are bristling with sentences like, no one can ever be in love more than once in their life. But that use of the pronoun fell into disrepute in the 19th century, when grammarians condemned it as incorrect and proclaimed that the so-called generic he should be used instead. The idea was that when you write, every singer has his range, the pronoun his refers to both men and women. Or as they sometimes put it, the masculine embraces the feminine. When second-wave feminists protested in the 1970s that the generic he was sexist, they roused a storm of indignation. They were accused of emasculating and neutering the language. The chairman of the Harvard Linguistics Department charged that they were suffering from pronoun envy. William Safire warned that to accept the use of they in place of he would be to cave in to the radic lib forces of usage permissiveness. In retrospect, those reactions betrayed the obtuseness that the psychologist Cordelia Fine calls delusions of gender. The fact is that the pronoun he is never gender neutral. If Sting had sung, "If you love somebody, set him free," it would have brought only a male to mind. What the language required was set them free. That gender-neutral singular they has history, English grammar, and gender equity on its side, and it's gradually been restored to the written language. Schoolroom crotchets can be hard to let go of, but we've largely leveled the linguistic playing field. At least, he no longer takes precedence over she. But that didn't make any provision for the rainbow of non-binary and non-conforming gender identities that have risen into public awareness in recent years. The language still required us to choose between he and she to refer to a specific individual. The singular they initially sounded awkward here. We can say somebody named Sandy was brushing their hair, where the pronoun replaces the nonspecific somebody. That's been standard colloquial English for centuries. But when somebody says just Sandy was brushing their hair, you're brought up short. Your first thought is that they must refer to some group of people whose hair Sandy was brushing. But you can make this work if you tweak your internal grammar so that the pronoun they can refer to a specific individual. It takes some practice to get the hang of it, but the human language processing capacity is more adaptable than people realize, even for geezers like me. When I read through an article about a non-binary person who uses they, them, and their as their pronouns, the pronouns ultimately sort themselves out. In context, they're rarely ambiguous, no more than any other pronoun. Tracy should take better care of themselves. Kelly hasn't made up their mind yet. That new use of they has passed muster with the AP's Style Guide and the American Heritage Dictionary. In theory, anybody can adopt it, whatever their gender identity. But we'll still be using he and she to refer to most individuals who identify as male and female. You can introduce new gender-neutral terms without driving out the gendered ones. Sibling has been in the language for more than 50 years, but we can still talk about brothers and sisters. When someone says Taylor has a lot going for them, it's a fair bet that that's the pronoun that Taylor prefers to be called by. It's not a lot to ask, just a small courtesy and sign of respect. In fact, the accommodations we're being asked to make for non-binary individuals are much less far-reaching than the linguistic changes that the feminists called for 50 years ago. Yet the reactions this time have been even more vehement than they were back then. A fifth-grade teacher in Florida, whose preferred pronouns are they, them, and their, was removed from the classroom when some parents complained about exposing their children to the transgender lifestyle. When the diversity office at the University of Tennessee at Knoxville published a guide to alternative pronouns in 2015, the state legislature promptly defunded the center and barred the university from promoting the use of gender-neutral pronouns in the future. Like the classic episodes of pronoun rage in earlier eras, those weren't about pronouns at all.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the University of California, Berkeley School of Information. Coming up, we hear from New Yorker staff writer Gia Tolentino. Her new collection of essays is written from the point of view of a feminist millennial. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is New Yorker staff writer Gia Tolentino. She describes her new collection of essays as focusing on what shaped her understanding of herself, this country, and this era. She writes about issues surrounding gender and feminism, including sexual harassment. She describes growing up in a Southern Baptist megachurch and why she left, growing up with the internet, how social media has blurred the line between opinion and action, why she left the Peace Corps, how she was invited to 46 weddings in a period of just a few years, and why she doesn't want to get married in spite of being in a long-term monogamous relationship. Before joining The New Yorker, she was deputy editor at the feminist website Jezebel. Her new book is called Trick Mirror, Reflections on Self-Delusion. Gia Tolentino, welcome to Fresh Air. You write a lot about feminism, and you write that some people see harsh criticism of women as always sexist. And as an example of that, you use some of the women in the Trump administration, like Kellyanne Conway, former members like Hope Hicks and Sarah Huckabee Sanders, some of Trump's family like Melania and Ivanka. And you say the legitimate need to defend women from unfair criticism has morphed into an illegitimate need to defend women from criticism categorically. So would you apply that to women in the Trump administration?
This essay where I write about this in the book, it came from, for a few years I worked in women's media, and for a couple of years I was an editor at the feminist site Jezebel, and often we would report on something like, let's say, the inadequacy of the idea of leaning in, or, you know, we would report on business practices by some female entrepreneur. And the immediate response we would get, not the only response, but one we would get consistently every time we did that, was, isn't the job of a feminist to build women up, not tear them down? And that seemed to me to be a misuse of the freedom that we have to be critical and to treat women with respect, which means reporting on them like any other human. And I started thinking about, you know, I think over the last 10 years, feminism has become very wonderfully so, a more mainstream point of view. Like, I think we saw it in the Me Too movement, this idea that women's stories were important and to be given credence and to be centered became more of the default, which was incredible to see. And as feminism has become more mainstream over the last 10 years, you know, part of that has been we've gotten good, you know, as a culture in general at sussing out sexism. You know, we've, like, when a woman is criticized for being shrill or crazy, right? We sort of know that those words are code for unlikable because you're a woman and you spoke for 30 seconds longer than I'd like you to. We've gotten great at protecting women against unfair criticism. But around a couple of years ago, I just started to notice this idea, this sort of protective, this sort of well-meaning protective impulse get twisted and co-opted and sort of stretched beyond any use or meaning. For example, when Melania Trump went to go visit the kids at the border wearing that Zara jacket that said, I don't care, I don't really care, do you, on the back. You know, and people very rightfully called her out for that being just an absolutely monstrous thing to do, an absolutely monstrous thing to do. And then, you know, the White House and conservative media sort of mounted what would nominally be a feminist defense, which is, you know, a woman has a right to wear whatever she wants. Don't talk about her looks or her clothing choices. And then the discourse got swallowed into, you know, 3 days of talking about whether or not it was sexist to criticize her clothes.
As a feminist writing, have you gotten criticized by other feminists?
Oh, of course. And that's okay.
That's okay, yeah, because feminists shouldn't have to have one
point of view.
I think, but if you've been criticized for having the wrong point of view and therefore being not a feminist.
You know, maybe I think that there's been this idea in feminism, you know, since the 1890s, there's this idea that disagreement will tear the whole ideology down, right? And that idea is there for a reason. It's there because, you know, male power has had such an intense stranglehold on America that I think there's reason to think that this coalition of people that believe that women are equal, you know, is constantly under threat to the point that we must present a united front. But I feel very conscious of, you know, I'm 30. I feel lucky to have been born at a time when I took it for granted as a kid that I could be what I wanted. And I've tried to think about what freedoms I have that women 10, 20, 30, 40 years older than me didn't when they were my age. And one of them is to not be threatened by disagreement and not be threatened by someone thinking that I'm wrong. I mean, I think that it's another thing that the internet sort of exacerbates is this idea that disagreement, you know, that it's really important to have everyone agree with you, you know, that means something. And for me, yeah, I mean, I think criticism is criticism coming from a sincere place is a really important thing.
You didn't grow up in a community that defined itself around feminism. You grew up in a Southern Baptist community that had, the church was on a huge campus. It was a mega church, so big that you say everyone called it the Repentagon.
We also called it Six Flags Over Jesus. also the Baptidome. We had lots of names.
Would you describe the church and the campus?
Yeah, so My parents are from the Philippines. I was born in Canada. But when I was, ever since I, like from age 4 to age 16, I basically spent my entire life within this megachurch in Houston, Texas. Or sorry, within this school in Houston, Texas that's attached to what by some statistics is the second biggest megachurch in the country. It's a Southern Baptist place. It's, you know, this massive campus. You could, as I wrote in the book, you could spend your whole life there, you know, elementary, nursery school through your funeral. You know, Houston is so large that this was like a town in itself, you know. And it was a trip. The school was, the population was extremely white and wealthy, which my family was not. I was on scholarship there for about half the time. And it was, you know, it was the kind of place where, you know, I had daily Bible class from first grade till senior year. You know, I had weekly chapel. I got my first promise ring, you know, my true love waits, you know, not going to have sex till marriage ring when I was in fourth grade. It was like Christian bodybuilders would come to chapel and rip apart phone books as sort of proof of the righteousness that you could acquire through Jesus. It was a really intense, insular, oftentimes dazzlingly beautiful, oftentimes terrifying, and extremely instructive environment. You know, my views are not at all conservative, and that was all that I experienced for the first half of my life. You know, I'm no longer religious, but it was an extremely formative experience for me.
The church held 6,500 people. That's really a lot of people. Were the services televised? Was it a TV church?
They were televised. My pastor, the better known pastor in Houston, is Joel Osteen, who, you know, runs Lakewood, and you see his books in airports all the time. That's not my pastor, but it was, you know, a similar sort of vibe. Billboards, church broadcast on TV every Sunday. There were campuses all across Houston. Tens of thousands of people would pass through every weekend. Christmas services would be in the Toyota Center, which is where the Houston Rockets play basketball. You know, that sort of scale.
So you eventually left the church. Are your parents still in that church?
My parents still go to that church. My parents were never particularly doctrinaire. They certainly don't believe in the prosperity gospel. They also never tried to really shape or control what I thought. I feel lucky for that. I think it's one of the things that, you know, even though every day I would walk into an environment that was extremely cloistered, at home I felt free to think. And they never questioned that, and they made sure that I felt that I had that freedom really early, and I'm grateful to them for that. Even though, of course, I am sure that you don't send your kid to Christian school for 12 years and hope that they'll do what I did, which is, you know, have the New Yorker publish 7,000 words about how the church led me to, like, love doing MDMA and love rap music, which is one of its most lasting legacies for me.
So you mentioned that in your life there's a connection between religion and certain drugs, like mushrooms and MDMA, also known as ecstasy, also known as Molly. What makes them similar in your mind?
So one tradition within Christianity and within religion in general that I've always been drawn to is the ecstatic tradition, right? It's this this idea that through attaining an ecstatic state, you reach a sort of union with God. And I found, you know, I found traces of that in my megachurch. We would be in this, you know, 6 feet of stained glass, and the lights would be down and everyone would have their hands up and the music would be so loud, and I would feel overwhelmed, you know. And this I'm talking about, you know, being age 7, age 11, age 16, you know, completely overwhelmed with a sense of ecstasy, a sort of nameless, powerful connection with the people around me and with something mysterious beyond me. And I loved that feeling, and my sort of inherent desire to reach for that feeling persisted long after my actual sense of religion or adherence to it or belief in God even, you know, after that went away. And there were places, you know, in Houston, I grew up in Houston in the early 2000s, and that was a period where Houston rap was a world unto its own. And there were, you know, I started to access that feeling in different dark rooms with everyone, when everyone had their hands up and everyone seemed sort of transported and out of their minds. I would get that feeling back over and over in college and afterwards, just in these situations that also led to ecstasy, you know, with that same exact feeling, and, you know, some, like, often with drugs. And I feel, and that essay is about my confusion about that, you know, like, I don't know, I wrote that I don't know whether it was because of this ecstatic tendency that I have in me that I believed in God in the first place. There's this sort of ecstatic leaning within many of us that manifests in the exact same words, the exact same feelings, no matter what the source. And it's not, and that's something that's certainly been true for me for a long time, but it is true for a lot of people.
You joined the Peace Corps after college, and I'm wondering if you joined in part because of your Baptist upbringing and the sense that you grew up with, that you wanted to do good. You wanted to be good, and you wanted to do good.
Yeah, I mean, I still have that sense. But yeah, I graduated in 2009, and part of it was, you know, it was smack in the middle of the recession. I was like, no one I know has a job. I will never be able to do the thing that I want to do, which is write, because I can't afford to move to New York. And so I applied to the Peace Corps, and I went to Central Asia and Kyrgyzstan.
Right, which is one of the former Soviet republics. So you get there, you were evacuated three times. Shortly after you got there, the government was overthrown. 88 people were killed. 500 injured. And then there was genocidal violence against the country's Uzbek population, 2,000 killed, 100,000 displaced. So you were living in a very tumultuous and dangerous time there. And you're right that the government seemed enlightened in the sense that the interim president was a woman, there were women in parliament, and the Constitution ensured equal rights for women, unlike our Constitution. But you experienced a serious lack of women's rights in your daily life there. And I want you to talk about that a little bit, like how you felt more vulnerable as a woman.
Yeah, it was devastating. I mean, I think of this time in the Peace Corps as the great failure of my life in a lot of ways, because I left after a year, partly because I was always in trouble because there were strict safety regulations that I kept breaking, but also because I was sexually harassed constantly. So Kyrgyzstan, you know, it seemed that women were running the place, but men were setting the terms. And there was incredible, you know, the women I knew were so strong, and they were dealing with, you know, the domestic violence was endemic. And I was harassed constantly, and sexual harassment before. Again, I've been conscious of mostly having enough confidence and enough power that whenever I was sexually harassed before and afterwards, I would just be like, screw you, you're a loser. You know, like anyone that would do that is a loser. But you can't think that when you're in the Peace Corps, you know?
Why couldn't you?
And I couldn't
why
that
couldn't
there.
You do that in the Peace Corps?
Because you're there, you know, you're there to say, I am here to serve you. You know, you're there to say that your life is more important than mine at this moment, and your happiness and your well-being is more important than mine, basically. And that is how I wanted to live there. And those wires got crossed, and I just found it impossible to understand what was happening. And, you know, and my host father kissed me one day, and it was just,
oh,
you know,
he grabbed you and kissed you. It wasn't like a thank you kiss. It was like, I'm...
Yeah, it wasn't a kiss on the cheek or whatever. No. It was, that would be lovely, you know? Something about that year, it was devastating. I was devastated to have more power than the women around me, and I also felt so powerless. And I couldn't process it, and it was tough, and it was incredibly instructive. And it was probably the hardest time in my life, and I'm also, like, one of the most important to me.
I want to get back to the thought you expressed of being in Kyrgyzstan as somebody representing the Peace Corps and thinking, I am here to serve you. On the other hand, the men want to subjugate me and render me powerless. It's so hard to wrap your head around that, because you can't honor that.
Right, right. And you know, you're there to live life in a lot of ways on Kyrgyz terms, or on the terms of your local community. And I did, you know, I covered my head. I often covered my head. I didn't always. Kyrgyzstan is sort of a syncretically Muslim post-Soviet country. I tried to follow local customs and, you know, to the extent that I was able to. But like there was just a part of it that I could never subject myself to. I couldn't let these cab drivers take me to their house and put me in a room for 2 hours and talk to me about making me their wife. You know, I couldn't do that. Oh, yeah. It happened to a lot of, yeah. I mean, these are villages where everyone knows everyone, and you sort of get around the country by hitchhiking. So you'll often, like, and it is a great sort of Central Asian nomadic and, like, also Muslim tradition to welcome strangers into your home, right? So, like, I would find myself eating with strangers all the time and be grateful for it, right? Grateful for them opening their house to me as a guest. And I, you know, part of your job is to get to know the community. And so, you know, so the lines were just so blurry between what I should be doing and what was intolerable, you know, and things would flip very quickly. And sometimes things would be both very wonderful and very bad at the same time. But, you know, at the same time that I was there to try to be a productive force in the community, you know, try to sort of put other people's needs above my own, it was also incredibly obvious that as an American, I had an escape hatch the way that none of the women around me did, right? I had all of this sort of lifetime capital and self-determination that many of the men around me didn't have, right? I had far more economic freedom than them. And it was just this very confounding mix of things.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Gia Tolentino is the author of the new collection of essays, Trick Mirror. She's also a staff writer at The New Yorker. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Roberta Shorrock, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Joel Wolfram. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.